Hello and welcome to Animal Rights, the Abolitionist Approach Commentary. I'm Gary Francione. This is our 20th No Frills, No Bells, No Whistles commentary concerning the abolition of animal exploitation, the failure of animal welfare regulation, veganism as the moral baseline of the animal rights movement, and the principle of ahimsa or nonviolence and its role in all of our advocacy efforts. Well, in this 20th commentary, I'm going to be speaking with Renata Peters and Jeff Purs, who live in Alice Springs, Australia. Now, Jeff is a Canadian, and Renata is Australian. And if you look on a map, you will see that although Alice Springs is in an area of Australia called the Northern Territory, it's sort of smack in the middle of the country, very far away from just about anything and everything else. And if you do any research on Alice Springs, you'll find that it's a fairly small community, and it's dominated by the cattle industry, and it's not the sort of place you would think would be particularly hospitable to vegan education. As a matter of fact, it's exactly the sort of place that you would look at and say, oh, well, vegan education is never going to work there. We're going to have cage-free eggs and happy exploitation because those people will never understand veganism. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And one of the exciting aspects of Jeff and Renata are doing in Alice Springs is that they are engaging in creative, nonviolent, vegan education in a situation that you would think would never be a fertile ground for vegan education. And I think those of us who are skeptical about vegan education need to listen to Renata and Jeff and learn from them that vegan education can occur anywhere if you want it to. And so we'll be getting to Renata and Jeff in a couple of minutes. I did want to say before we spoke with them, I wanted to comment on a British campaign that I think illustrates in many ways the problems of animal welfare campaigns as a general matter, and is a particularly striking example of the ill-advised nature of these campaigns. Animal Aid is a British animal welfare organization. They did an investigation into slaughterhouses, and lo and behold, what did they find in slaughterhouses? They found that animals are being abused. Well, they are slaughterhouses. They're not places where animals go for recreation, or, you know, they're not like sort of resort places. They're slaughterhouses. So Animal Aid found that animals were being abused, that they weren't being slaughtered in accordance with the regulations that are there to protect them, to make sure that their slaughter, that the hideous, violent end of their life is humane. So what was Animal Aid's response? Was it to say, look, British public, this can never be done properly, and even if it were done properly, whatever that means, it would still be morally wrong because we would still be killing these animals for no reason other than the fact that they taste good or you know, it's convenient for us, or we've been doing it for a long time or whatever, and that we really need to focus on veganism. Was that the response? No. The response was that Animal Aid, and I'm reading this now, is calling for CCTV, closed-circuit TV cameras, to be installed in UK slaughterhouses and for the footage to be made available to independent parties outside of the slaughterhouse. We also want better independent training, regular retraining and assessment, rigorous enforcement of the laws, and an end to those with outstanding convictions for violence or animal cruelty working in slaughterhouses. So what was Animal Aid's response to discovering that slaughterhouses are horrible places? The response was, let's put closed-circuit TV cameras in slaughterhouses, let's have training programs for workers, and let's make sure that people who engage in violence and cruelty to animals don't work in slaughterhouses. I mean, there's a sense in which if this if it's not immediately apparent to you why this is wrong, it's not clear to me that any amount of discussion in this commentary is going to persuade you. But it should be clear to you that this is really, to call it a crazy idea is to insult crazy ideas, actually. Because here you have an animal organization, large animal organization in Britain, saying the solution to the problem of the horror of slaughterhouses is to have closed-circuit TV cameras and to have monitoring and to have training programs and to make sure that people who engage in violence and cruelty don't work in slaughterhouses. Well, slaughterhouses are places in which animals are slaughtered. I have been in them. If you have never been in them, I would suggest you go visit one. There is no way to do it, quote, properly. They are slaughterhouses. They are places where animals are slaughtered. The solution to the horrors of the slaughterhouse is not to put television cameras in, have certification programs, and generally whitewash the blood of the slaughterhouse to reassure the British public that things can be done properly and they can feel comfortable about continuing to eat animal products as long as they're buying meat from supermarkets that get their meat from slaughterhouses that have television cameras. And that's exactly, by the way, what Animal Aid is advising. Animal Aid is saying that what can the consumer do? The consumer can make sure that they buy their meat from supermarkets that get their meat from slaughterhouses that have closed-circuit TV cameras. Now, you know it's just a matter of time before all the American groups are going to jump on this. I mean, this is just a bandwagon that people won't be able to resist, like the Animal Abuse Registry that I wrote about on abolitionistapproach.com last week. These are bandwagons that these welfarists will not be able to resist. But I want us to focus for a second on the craziness of this sort of campaign. I mean, there was an article in one of the British newspapers about how a slaughterhouse that had been that had its supply contract suspended with one of the large supermarket chains, because that slaughterhouse was one of the slaughterhouses that Animal Aid had identified as an abusive slaughterhouse. And so Sainsbury's, which is a large British supermarket chain, they suspended buying meat from this slaughterhouse because it had been identified by Animal Aid as one of these slaughterhouses that was abusing animals. And now Sainsbury's is buying meat again from the slaughterhouse because the slaughterhouse has improved its welfare standards and has installed closed-circuit TV cameras. And Andrew Tyler of Animal Aid was quoted as saying, it shows, that is the resupplying of meat by this slaughterhouse to Sainsbury's, it shows quite clearly the importance of our investigation, that the company says its own standards have improved dramatically. That underlines in absolutely clear terms that what we are doing and what we will continue to do is a vital task. We are pleased that CCTV, closed-circuit TV cameras, has been introduced. It's absolutely vital that the footage is not just collected, but is regularly scrutinized by Sainsbury's and the regulatory authority. So here we have Andrew Tyler saying, oh, well, this just shows how important Animal Aid is. Just shows how important our company is, our business is. That we have the slaughterhouse acknowledging that it's improving its own standards. And now the British public can be assured that these animals are being treated in a, quote, humane way, or at least the worst abuses are sort of being dealt with by closed-circuit TV cameras and by monitoring by the proper authorities. You know, it used to be the case that the church would tell people if you wanted to engage in various activities that were considered to be sinful, you could do it. And you wouldn't have to worry about going to hell because you could pay a donation to the church and get something called an indulgence. And that would allow you to get to heaven even if you had done all sorts of horrible things, because the church would forgive you. And that's exactly what these modern animal rights groups are doing. They're doing what the church was doing several hundred years ago. They're selling indulgences. They're saying, look, you want to continue to exploit animals, that's fine. But just do so. And just make sure that you purchase animal products that are the results of happy exploitation. This is the problem with this whole happy exploitation movement. All it is doing is reassuring the public that it's all right to continue consuming animals, that there's a way of doing this properly. And I suggest to you people, there is no way. There is no way. There is no slaughterhouse on the earth that is not a hellhole, that is not a place of unspeakable tragedy. There is no such thing as a good slaughterhouse, not even the ones that Temple Grandin designed and that the American Animal Group, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, gave her an award for. Not even Temple Grandin slaughterhouses. They're nothing but hideous hellholes. Places of squalor, noise, hideous conduct, death, mistreatment. All of them. Every single one of them. And even if there were one that was the humane slaughterhouse, the one that in which animals didn't suffer at all, they would still be being killed. We would still be taking their lives because they taste good. We need, as a society, if we care about animals, and I believe that we do, we need to have a different discussion. We need to move the discussion away from treatment and move the discussion toward use. That's never going to happen when you have these large animal organizations telling the public, hey, you can continue to consume. Give us a donation. Get your indulgence. Go to Sainsbury's or whatever supermarket you shop at and purchase meat from slaughterhouses that have closed-circuit TV cameras and education programs for employees. And it's okay. That's not the message we want to be sending. It's not the message we should send. It's the wrong message. It's a message of appeasement. And what these large organizations are doing is they are becoming active partners in exploitation with institutional users. They're becoming active partners. This is not helping animals. It's not helping animals at all. What it's doing is making the public more comfortable about animal exploitation. I mean, the idea that we say, well, we don't want people who engage in violence against animals or cruel treatment of animals working in slaughterhouses. I mean, how crazy is that? Think about it. How crazy is that? I would suggest it's pretty crazy. You know, you won't be surprised to hear that there are many animal advocates who are unhappy with this campaign. And many of them have expressed their dissatisfaction to Animal Aid. And a colleague of mine in Britain sent me an email that she received from Andrew Tyler of Animal Aid in response to her objection to this campaign. And what Tyler says in this email, and it will be posted on the blog essay that accompanies this commentary, is he basically says, well, you know, these animals are going to be slaughtered. It's better that we stop some of the worst abuses, even if they are going to be slaughtered. And he gives the following, he says, take this example. This is a quote from Tyler. Take this example. You are at a livestock market and see a sheep repeatedly kicked in the head and stamped on. Do you intervene to end the extreme abuse, or would you regard that as welfareist, given that even if you stopped the kicking and stamping, the sheep will still be slaughtered? So he's basically saying, well, you know, is it welfareist to stop a sheep from being kicked by someone? If you were at a livestock auction, would you stop that? Now, the answer to that is yes, of course. And let me say this. That example in various forms has been kicking around. I've been doing this for almost 30 years, and that sort of example has been if I use the expression kicked around just now, that it was an unfortunate pun, stomped around. If that example has been used for years, decades now. As a matter of fact, it was used in the early 90s by Ingrid Newkirk in response to the criticism of myself and others about welfare reform. And I wrote about Newkirk in my 1996 book, Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement. And Newkirk used a different example. She said, well, if you are opposed to welfare reform, then what do you say to the cow who's on the way to being slaughtered and she's thirsty? Do you not have rules that require that she be given water on the way to the slaughterhouse? Isn't that a good thing to campaign for? Shouldn't we put our effort, our time and effort into welfare reform to make sure that cows get water on the way to the slaughterhouse? And wouldn't you give water to a cow on the way to the slaughterhouse if it were your decision? And the answer is, yes, of course I would, but that doesn't mean that it's a good idea to campaign for water for cows on the way to the slaughterhouse. The example I used in my 1996 book was, let's assume you're working in a concentration camp in which people are being confined because they have political views that we don't like, and we are killing them. We're executing them and torturing them and doing all sorts of hideous things to them. Well, let's assume someone is being dragged off to the torture killing room, and on the way there says to me, gee, I'm really thirsty. Can I have a drink of water? Should I give that person a drink of water? And the answer is yes, of course I should. Of course I should. Now, let's assume that the following morning I wake up and I say, you know, I've got a really horrible job. I'm working as a guard in a concentration camp in which political prisoners are being tortured and killed. And that's a really bad thing. I mean, that camp shouldn't exist. So I'm going to quit my job. And I'm going to quit my job. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start campaigning to make sure that all political prisoners in that camp are given water on the way to the torture killing house. And after I succeed in that, that'll take me a while. And after, you know, because we've got to do that. But then after that, I'm going to campaign for them to get soy lattes, and I'm going to promote that they get a meal, a really good meal, before they're tortured and killed, and that they get better beds. The beds that they're sleeping on are not particularly comfortable, and I think they should have more comfortable beds. So I'm going to campaign for all of these things. Would we find that peculiar? Certainly we would. Nobody would think that the appropriate response to the concentration camp for political prisoners is to make sure that all political prisoners get a glass of water on the way to the torture killing house. That's not to say that if I were in the situation where I was standing there and the prisoner asked me for a glass of water, should I give the prisoner a glass of water? And the answer is yes, of course I should. But if I decide that the institution is immoral, inherently immoral, what do I do? What is the appropriate response to that situation? And I suggest to you the appropriate response is not to campaign and spend the rest of my life trying to get glasses of water for political prisoners. And similarly, you know, the example that Tyler gives, well, if you're at a livestock auction and you see some person kicking a sheep, wouldn't you stop that? And the answer is yeah. But so would the owner of the sheep, because if someone's kicking the sheep, that's going to decrease the value of the sheep, because if the sheep has carcass damage, that's going to make the sheep meat unfit for human consumption, and it's going to result in a decrease in value of the animal carcass. And so I would suspect that the owner of the sheep would also stop the kicking of the sheep. And if it were the owner of the sheep who was kicking the sheep, we would say, look, owner, you're decreasing the value of the animal commodity, and that is not good as a social matter, because we don't want, we're going to exploit animals and we want to do so in an economically efficient way, and you're engaging in economically inefficient behavior by decreasing the value of the animal carcass for no good reason other than the fact that you enjoy kicking the sheep, and we're going to stop you from doing that. So should we do that? Yes, and I suspect that there would be multiple incentives to stop the person from kicking the sheep. But does it make sense then that what we're going to do is campaign for rules that stop the kicking of sheep at livestock auctions? Is that how we should spend our time? Or should we spend our time educating people about why they shouldn't be consuming sheep in the first place? Now, I would suggest to you that the idea, I think that this closed-circuit TV camera campaign is so crazy that it's bizarre, actually. But what I'd like you to think about is, Newkirk made that response about the thirsty cow in the early 90s. I think it was like 91, 92 in which she made that comment. So it was almost 20 years ago. And she was saying, 20 years ago, we've got to support welfare reform because it's the only way we're going to make things better and move towards animal rights. Same thing that Tyler's saying now in 2010. We've got to have closed circuit TV cameras in slaughterhouses because this is the way we're gonna move the animal rights agenda forward. I would suggest that's nonsense. It's been 20 years since Newkirk made that statement, and you know what? We're consuming more animals now. We're using more animals now in more horrific ways than at any time in human history. And per capita consumption of animal products is going up. It's not going down. And I would suggest to you a primary reason why it is going up is because you have all of these big animal organizations, these animal welfare organizations, telling people, yeah, we've got all these labels. We've got the animal compassionate label. We've got the humane raised and handled label. And we've got the humane choice label. And we've got, the RSPCA freedom food label. And we've got all these happy exploitation labels. And we've got closed circuit TV cameras in slaughterhouses. And we've got, we've got Temple Grandin out there making sure the cows are so happy about being in the slaughterhouse that they're actually applying to be slaughtered in Temple Grandin approved slaughterhouses and all of this nonsense. And what we're doing is making people think that the problem is treatment, that we can make the treatment better, and that if we make the treatment better, we can be conscientious omnivores, or what Peter Singer calls conscientious omnivores, which he describes as a morally defensible position that if we're careful to eat animal products that come from animals that have been humanely treated, that's a morally defensible position. I would suggest to you it is not. I would suggest to you that that whole way of thinking is going in the wrong direction. That what it is doing is making the public more comfortable about animal exploitation. It's putting a happy face, it's putting a smiling face on death, on torture. It's the wrong way to go, people. It's the wrong way to go. So I would strongly suggest that you do not support the animal aid closed circuit TV campaign or anything like it. In a future commentary, I am going to do something on the greatest hits of the modern animal welfare movement, in which I will take the top 10 crazy welfare reform proposals. And it will be hard. Actually, it will be hard to winnow it down to 10. But I can assure you, closed circuit TV cameras in slaughterhouses will be one of the 10. But in any event, please don't support those sorts of campaigns. They're silly. And if you are a member of Animal Aid, write to Animal Aid and express your objection to the campaign. And while you're at it, please write to my friends at Viva in the United Kingdom and ask them to please stop promoting the idea that there's a difference between animal flesh and other animal products. That's a common theme that we see with a lot of these animal organizations, that they are promoting vegetarianism rather than veganism, and thus suggesting that, and in some cases explicitly stating that, that animal products other than flesh are somehow less morally problematic, that dairy products are less morally problematic than animal flesh. That's ridiculous. Animals used for dairy production are kept alive longer. They're treated every bit as badly as animals used for meat, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse anyway. And Viva is selling cookbooks that are not vegan. They're promoting restaurants and inns that are not vegan. And this is just sending the wrong message. I understand that it's economically beneficial for them to do so, but I think that it's important for people to make clear to these organizations, we've got your number, and we understand what you're doing, and we don't think you should be doing it. And so please, express your concern to these organizations. I'm not particularly confident that it will result in their moving in a good direction, but at least they'll see that people out there are paying attention and are not being taken in by the happy exploitation propaganda, and by and that people are aware of the fact that these large organizations are becoming active partners in exploitation. That they're really promoting animal exploitation, and that's a bad thing. Okay, well, now we will move on to my discussion with Jeff Purs and Renata Peters. All right, well, in this part of the podcast, what I would like to do is to discuss with two abolitionist vegan advocates their creative nonviolent vegan advocacy. And I have with me today, from Alice Springs, Australia, Jeff Purs and Renata Peters. I have known Jeff for some years. Jeff has been involved in the animal advocacy movement for a number of years, and he is very, very interested, and has been for a long time, in creative, nonviolent, vegan outreach and advocacy and education, and he's been thinking about it for a long time. And so I was interested to hear that he and Renata recently have decided to do abolitionist vegan advocacy in Alice Springs, Australia. And I'd like to talk with them about the experiences that they're having. So welcome, Jeff, and welcome, Renata. Are you there?
Thank you, Gary. It's great to be here.
Great.
Hi.
Hi. Now, Jeff is Canadian, Renata is from Australia, and they're living in Alice Springs. So this is a real interesting, and we're all talking on Skype right now. In any event, okay. Well, Jeff, Renata, please tell me a little bit about your background and how you came to where you are now.
Would you like to go first, Ren?
Well, Jeff and I have been together for about 6 years, but coincidentally, we've both been vegans for about 13 to 14 years. I grew up in Australia and just grew up in Canada. But we found each other on the internet. So we fell in love online, and Jeff left his life behind and came to Australia. And the relationship worked very well, and now we share our passion for veganism and animal advocacy. And we live in Alice Springs, which is right in the middle of Australia in the outback.
And you're doing vegan advocacy in Alice Springs in the outback.
Yeah, our population for the town is about 28,000. It's really is in the middle of nowhere. It takes about a 2-day drive in any direction to get to the next beach or city. so we're very, very remote. But the internet makes the world very small, so we can do advocacy anywhere, internationally.
And we also get hundreds of thousands of tourists every year, which, adds something to our population of 28,000.
The town is an interesting mix of people. It has a very high indigenous population of Australia's Aboriginal people. We also have a lot of tourists, mainly from Germany, England, and Japan. And we also have a lot of cattle station owners. They're people who have cows. So it's beef cattle country, they nickname this place. So we're right in the heart of cattle country. And
and we've got an American spy base from where all the bombs get coordinated from. And we've also got a lot of hippies and environmental types, so there's a real interesting mix here.
It's definitely an interesting mix. Yeah, we have about 2,000 Americans who live in Alice Springs, and they get on a secret bus with blacked-out windows that takes them out of town to a place called Pine Gap, where they have a secret spy base.
Donald Rumsfeld visited last year, I think.
Well, it can't be too secret if everybody knows about it.
It's supposed to be secret.
It's basically an underground facility where they have all their satellite computers and so on.
Yeah, they watch the satellites. That's what they do.
Drop bombs on people.
It's a military base. Mm.
You've really got a very interesting situation there. What is the foundation of the tourist base? Is it just coming to see natural attractions or natural
That's
features?
Right. Yeah, the biggest attraction is a six-hour drive away from here called Uluru. The traditional name is Uluru, but for many years it's been called Ayers Rock, a big, huge red rock in the middle of the desert. So lots of tourists come to see the rock, and they get here to Alice Springs first and then go to the rock.
I think Gary wanted to know, Ren, what brought you to veganism and abolitionism?
Sort of a multitude of inspirations that made me go vegan. I was in Sydney at the time, and I guess from a young age I've been an environmentalist. I've always loved the planet and cared very much about the rainforests and endangered species, but I've never known anything about animal rights. And there were a few friends that were vegans. They never ever told me why. I wish they had. But just having them around me was an inspiration because they were very healthy and happy people. It's kind of, I feel a bit embarrassed really. The biggest thing that made me go vegan was Anthony Robbins, actually. Tony Robbins, you know, the giant man, the big teeth from America. He comes to Australia once a year and conducts a seminar called Unleash the Power Within, and you go firewalking.
Did you go firewalking?
I did. It was fantastic. Is it true?
Now, I have to ask you a question. For those of you who don't know, Anthony Robbins is a motivational speaker. I think he's based out of California, as a matter of fact. That's just a guess, but I'm sure all motivational speakers are based out of California. And he advocates, one of the things he does is, as I understand it, advocates sort of a mind control mechanism and tells you that if you want, you can walk on fire barefoot. Now, is this true? Did you do it?
He makes it clear that it's not mind over matter, and he says you can totally do it, and the reason that people do it, if they want to, and most people do, is that it's a symbol. The coals are your obstacle, and you look towards your goal, and you go across the coal. It's really a confidence booster. After you do it, you really seriously think you can do anything. So he's very clear that anybody can walk across the coals. It's scientifically possible. It's not some mind over matter thing or anything. It's really a symbolic ceremony.
I'm sorry. I'm a little. Are you telling me that the coals are hot, right?
Oh yeah. They were glowing orange hot. You don't obviously stand in there and let your skin boil, but if you just walk confidently, you don't have to run or anything, but you can walk across 3 to 4 meters of hot coals and get to the other side, and then there's somebody standing with a hose and they hose out the coals from out of your feet.
I think it's something to do with the surface area or texture of the rocks they use, which if you only put your foot on for a short time, then you don't get burned. But that's just my guess.
When I was 11, I went. I did a fire walking ceremony with a Tahitian group that visited Australia, and they all spoke French. And they brought hot volcanic rocks. Well, they weren't hot when they brought them, but they heated them up in a big pit on the beach. And I walked across that as well, and had the same euphoric feeling doing that. And it was like, I don't know, 860 Celsius degrees or something, which is, you know, 4 times as hot as an oven in your house.
Wait, but you're telling me that this was a French group, and you're telling me that these coals did not have cream sauce poured over them? All right. and so you came to veganism through Robbins. Does he advocate veganism?
Well, yes, he does. But so on the final day of his seminar, it's a focus on health, and he talks about, it's all focused on health. He talks about the health benefits of eating plant-based foods and how bad meat and dairy is for you. And he's got a stadium of thousands of people attending this seminar, and he's pushing the health side of it. But I do believe he eats fish, but he doesn't talk about fish there. But if you read the fine print, you do uncover that he does eat fish as well. So he's not actually vegan, but he does say it. He says he recommends a vegetarian/vegan diet. So That was where the inspiration came from. But the biggest one was in his book, Awaken the Giant Within, which I'll just have to say, before I got to that book, I would never have read Anthony Robbins, because just the sight of him turns me off. And we have a funny thing with Australian culture where we'd be pulled off by a guy like that. But because my friend Olivia was so inspiring to me, she'd had a black belt in taekwondo and played polo with the horses and was studying business, and she's just such a high achiever, and she'd jog across the Harbour Bridge to get to work, and she was a vegan. She was just this incredible person, and she would sleep 4 to 5 hours a night. She had all this energy, she wouldn't tell me anything about veganism. She was just an inspiration on her own, and so I paid attention to her and thought, wow, she's done so much. And I'd ask her, what's the secret behind all this? And she said, look, you've got to go and see Tony Robbins. I did all these seminars and it changed my life. So that's the direction I went. So I read the book, Awaken the Giant Within, which is really a motivational book. And at the end, there's a chapter dedicated to the work of John Robbins, who's no relation to him, and took some facts from his famous, but I think it's like 25 years old now or something, A Diet for a New America, which chapter by chapter states all the facts and the environmental and health costs and the treatment of animals. And it was a complete wake-up call. I had no idea about these things. So that got my attention. Because I was a greenie, I had no clue that 90% of the destruction of the Amazon rainforest was for meat production, that basically the forest is being turned into meat. So that was the big thing that got my attention. It wasn't enough to make me go vegan straight away, but it certainly turned my head. So I read that chapter and started to become interested in veganism and vegetarianism. And so after that, it was about a year of accumulating information. I'm someone who needs a lot of facts, and I never make a decision lightly. But once I do make a decision, I definitely go all the way. I'd had some practice earlier in my life. So this is about the age of 20 that I'm talking about. I'm 33 now. But when I was a teenager, at age 15, I had a New Year's resolution never ever to drink alcohol or take any drugs or anything like that. So I decided I was going to be completely drug-free for life. But I'd already had been up to that point, but I made a solid decision that I was going to do that. So I've got plenty of practice of making decisions and sticking to it. So when it came time to become a vegan, I knew that once I made that decision, there was no turning back. And once I knew what I knew, I just could never turn back. So after reading that chapter in that book from John Robbins, and then about a year, I needed information about health. So I got a lot of information about why it's good for you, and not just why it's good for you, but how bad for you animal products are. So I needed the health side of it. And after about a year, I had this epiphany and knew I was going. I said, oh, my God, I'm going to become a vegetarian. I'm never going to eat meat again. And I was vegetarian for about 2 weeks, because after that, from Sydney, I flew to Hawaii. And I was working there as a photographer's assistant in the surfing scene, working on the beach all day long, hard work. And I'd just become a vegetarian. I had no idea what to eat. So I went to the health food store. Never been to a health food store in my life. I found a hummus sandwich or something like that. I just had no clue what to do. There was that book, A Diet for a New America. So I remembered it from Anthony Robbins' book. So I got it. And I ate that book in 3 days, and I was an instant vegan. My life changed forever from
so
that
you,
moment.
So you were basically an interesting combination of ethical, environmental, and health reasons for they all sort of all came together for you and helped inform and shape your decision to become a vegan.
That's right. For me, it wasn't any one thing. It wasn't enough to learn about the cruelty of animals, because I had very powerful beliefs. I remember seeing a street stall when I was 18, 2 years before I went, or 2 or 3 years before I went vegan, a street stall in Sydney, very busy part of Sydney, with pictures of factory farms. It was the first time I'd ever seen. I had no idea what a factory farm was. So I saw these images of factory farms and read about some cruelty. And I spent a bit of time at that stall reading and thinking, oh my gosh, this is horrible and cruel. And I remember my next thought, well, I can't go vegetarian because we're supposed to eat meat and it's natural to eat meat and we just have to treat them better. I remember that was my first thought.
Now, that's it. That's interesting to me because this is one of the arguments I use all the time about why we shouldn't focus on treatment, because if we do, what we end up getting people to, you know, their reaction is not go vegan. Their reaction is make it better, make the treatment better.
That's exactly what my reaction was.
Yeah. Well, okay, Jeff, how about you? How did you get there?
Well, just on that subject, jumping sort of in the middle of my vegan journey, so to speak, I remember when I was at university hosting some film nights showing documentaries of...
Now, this was in Canada?
Yeah, in Canada. Documentaries of animal exploitation and so on in the food industry. And without fail, at the end of it, everyone would always say something like, oh, it's so horrible, but, you know, we can make it better. And I don't agree with that, but, you know, we'll, you know, make some laws or something or buy Happy Meat or whatever. So, yeah, whenever I showed these film nights, that was the response. And so then I learned to give an introductory talk beforehand and then question and answers afterwards to give them the abolitionist message as well. But if you were to just to show the horrible images of factory farming and slaughterhouses and so on, everyone's default position is welfarism. So, yeah, that needs to be addressed. But, yeah, in general, I went vegan sort of different from Renata. I took my first year university bioethics course, and one of the subjects in that was the ethics of abortion. And I'm pro-choice, but when you look at the philosophical arguments for and against abortion, it looks at the reasons for what makes a person. For example, isn't it the capacity to reason or to have human language or to be genetically human, or is it to feel pain, and all of these various qualities, and then all of the reasons for and against accepting or rejecting them. And so that's when I first started thinking about this stuff, and just doing that, I went vegetarian, and then I started attending animal groups and seeing the horrible images of what happens to animals who we eat, and then from there I went vegan. So for me, it was more of a rational thing, looking at all of the arguments, and then it became emotional when I saw those pictures. And then for several years, I did animal rights activism on the street, just going protesting McDonald's with PETA and all that crap. And then luckily, I came across your book, Gary, Rain Without Thunder, and when I read that, I struggled to find reasons why you were wrong. I fought against you.
You and many other people.
and I failed, and so I had to admit to myself that you were right. And I became abolitionist, and I stopped going to all the welfarist events. And eventually, the main form of activism I came to was using audiovisual kiosks, where you just put them on the sidewalk and people see images of animal exploitation. And the reason I like that is because, unlike the conventional protest, where everyone is hostile and passersby try to get away as soon as they can and they don't look at what you say and they just want to get away, we're doing this audiovisual kiosk thing, people just are shocked by what they see, but then they stop and they look, and it's very quiet and somber. And then they approach me and start asking me questions about, well, what's this and why are you here and so on.
Now, this is I want to focus on this for a second, because I think this is really important. What I hear you saying is that the sort of the traditional demonstration is itself a situation where you set up a sort of a dynamic of conflict, and that dynamic of conflict spreads over into the actual communication with people. So, and you're saying that the kiosk is a more inviting form of discourse because now what Jeff is talking about, if I understand what you're meaning, Jeff, is you're talking about those little portable devices that a number of folks have. I haven't seen them, and I agree with you. I think they are very effective. I haven't seen one in a while, but they're portable little devices which one sets up on a street or street corner or whatever, and there's a video monitor inside, and you show some sort of video, and people come by, and they obviously they're walking down the street. If they don't wish to engage you, they just keep walking. You don't have the dynamic of a demonstration. It's a very, very different sort of dynamic, and people come up. The people who come up choose to come up. They choose to stop. They choose to watch, and it's a personal, it's a more personal experience than the experience of the demonstration, which is a more group experience, and involves group dynamics of a positive and negative nature. This is a more individual experience, and there is an opportunity for the person to engage someone who is standing by the kiosk providing information. So that's the situation you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's right. I would add, though, that there is sometimes there can be a group dynamic as well as a personal dynamic, because if you have a high street population density where there's a lot of people in a relatively small area, what happens or what tends to happen is one person will stop and watch the video, and then once one person stops, a whole bunch of people stop and watch, and you can have arcs or semicircles of people, say a group of 20 even, all watching in silence at the same time, and then eventually one person will come and ask a question and others will listen, and then from there you can have several discussions. One thing I would like to say is I know you've blogged on the subject of using horribly violent images, and you've said that there's no right or wrong answer to this, but there is always the danger that by showing these horrible images, people will fall back to the, you know, what they've been taught by society, which is animal welfare. Oh, the images on these videos are horrible, but let's make it better and let's not go vegan. So that's always a danger when you do use videos like that.
But yeah.
I try to prevent that as much as I can with the self-made literature that I produce and with everything I say to people who I talk with.
Now, you've been pretty independent for your. I think both of you have been. I mean, you're not part of any large group,
no.
Right? And so what you're doing, what you've been doing in the past, Jeff, what you've been doing in the past, Renata, and what you're now doing together, is basically your own work. You're independent advocates.
I think I'd recommend that actually. When some people ask, well, what can I do? I always recommend. I think you should actually start your own group.
All right, so tell me a little bit about what you're doing now in Alice Springs, population 28,000, far away from everywhere. But I haven't
considered using the video here because, there are a few reasons. One is you don't get as much street traffic, and so it tends not to be effective when that's the case. And the other thing is, we have limited opportunities when we can do it. We'll be doing it every 2 weeks they're called Sunday markets, where there's food and crafts and various things for sale, and we'll be there with our stall, and there'll be children around, so
it's a family event
more than just usual. So yeah, I think the video thing would work as well here. But what we are doing is we set up a tent, and we have posters, and we have pamphlets and free cupcakes, and we just talk to people and encourage veganism from an abolitionist perspective.
And you're doing vegan cupcakes. That's great.
Yes, Renata makes those.
That's great. That's terrific.
And I make sure that they are damn good.
Yes, I'm sure. Well, you know, I'll tell you, I remember when I became a vegan almost 30 years ago,
there was a real food wasteland out there in a lot of ways. Well, yes, there was a food wasteland and there wasn't a food wasteland. I mean, when I became a vegan, I was so enculturated with the standard American diet that, you know, my initial impulse was to look for processed food, and there was not a lot of processed food. There was very little processed vegan food back then. And it never occurred to me that, well, you know, just eat fruits, vegetables, and nuts because that's, you know, both healthy for you and easily, you know, accessible. But, you know, it was years before I really had creative vegan food. As a matter of fact, I remember I remember going to an event very early on in which I was speaking about animal rights, and the people from Gentle World were there, and at the time I believe they were out of Florida. I know they're now in New Zealand and in Hawaii, but at the time they were in Florida, and Gentle World was a vegan commune, basically, and one of the things they did was they promoted veganism by going to various events and having this terrific vegan food that no one had ever eaten before, because there really wasn't a tradition at that time, at least in this country, of really delicious, creative, gourmet sort of vegan foods. And I remember going to this event and tasting some of the food that these folks from Gentle World made, and it was spectacular. And it was my first introduction to really delicious vegan food. And now we're at a point where there really isn't anything. I mean, first of all, people should be concerned about their health. So as far as eating processed foods is concerned, you should avoid that, because they have, you know, processed foods have virtually no nutritive value. But it's so easy now to get and make delicious vegan food, and I'm sure that the people who are eating your cupcakes, Renata, are just in a state of awe that such things can be produced without animal products. But the reality is they can, yeah. You know, and they're delicious. I mean, you know, it's like I frequently, you know, will try various vegan things that people have made, and just the terrific things that can be done now with vegan cooking is just remarkable. But anyway, so tell me a little bit about what the activism that's going on now. Oh, Jeff, now I want to ask you, where were you doing this vegan advocacy, Jeff, with the kiosk? Where were you doing this?
The first time I ever did it was in Hamilton, Ontario, on the campus of McMaster University. Then I did it in Paris, France. And then I did it in Kingston, Ontario.
Wow. Okay. So you've done it in different places. And did you, as a general matter, what was the sort of reaction you would get when you talked to people? Did you feel that the educational efforts were successful?
Yes, I did. The reaction I got, there were some hostile people, but those were the exception. But most people just had a quiet, somber expression on their face, and they said, well, I had signs and stuff about veganism, and so I guess they would start off with just a general air of concern, but then they would perhaps raise some respectfully phrased objections and to veganism, and I would answer them using, you know, my rational arguments, and a lot of them would say, yeah, that makes sense. Or some of them would say, oh, well, what you say makes sense, but I could never go vegan. And so in situations like that, I would say, well, why don't you try to go vegan gradually? If you agree with what I'm saying, then go vegan once a week, and then after a while, 2 days a week, and so on until you're totally vegan, and go at your own pace. And then people said, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
All right, so this is interesting. You were using, in the earlier phase of your advocacy, you were using the kiosk in large urban areas, and having a good degree of success with that. And now you're in a non-urban area, more a more remote area where you don't have that sort of street traffic, You're not using the kiosk anymore, and rather you're using just literature and what we might want to call food activism of
food
of plying people with delicious cupcakes.
Rule out using video in the future, but for now I'm content not using it.
The tent that we have now also does not have any graphic photographs or anything like that. It's we have lots of posters with facts, all kinds of environmental, health, and ethical, you know, quotes, things that'll get people thinking or draw people in. So we'll have like a big poster with big writing that'll something really interesting that'll draw people in with curiosity to ask questions. And we have the cupcakes right up the front.
And the free cupcakes.
With a sign that says free cupcake with a conversation. And we have your pamphlets up the front and the Boston Vegan Association Respecting Animals Means Being Vegan pamphlet as well, plus a whole lot of information that I've spent hours poring myself over, facts on the environment and climate change and all those sorts of things as well. So it's just a hub of information. The first eco fair that we did a few weeks back now, a lot of people were so surprised that the cupcakes were free, because everything at the eco fair you had to buy. There was we were put in the food area, and so you could buy food, you could buy T-shirts, you could buy all kinds of products and crafts and things, and we were the only people offering free things. So people were really happy to get a yummy treat that was free and either a quick conversation or a pamphlet, and they could run away with their cupcake if they were too frightened to talk.
Sorry to interrupt, but also I should mention across from us was the only vegetarian restaurant in Alice Springs, and we had actually invited them to that fair and asked that they only serve vegan items, and they agreed to that. So as we were educating people about veganism and so on, they had our cupcakes, and then we could point them across the way to some other delicious vegan food.
Yeah, we have some lovely Taoist friends in Alice Springs as a community here, people from Taiwan and Singapore, various Asian countries, and they live in Alice Springs, and they get together for Taoist philosophy talks and ceremonies, and they, or one of the families, runs the tea shrine, which is mostly vegan with some vegetarian options. I asked the tea shrine if they don't normally do stalls, they only have their cafe, but they did it especially for us because they were really happy to be involved and help our advocacy. And so there was a family there selling really, really yummy Asian food, like handmade dumplings and sushi, and they had iced tea and that sort of thing. And I made a sign that went along with the iced tea, and it said, "Green tea really is greener. The milk in a cup of tea costs more carbon than boiling the water." So that was a little sign that went along, because we're at an eco fair, right? So the focus of the fair was living sustainably. So we had a lot of environmental facts, which was the theme of the fair.
And Renata gave a half-hour presentation on the environmental reasons for veganism, and then I followed with a half-hour presentation on the ethical abolitionist reasons, and we spoke to the same group, so that was really good.
And the talk went really well, and it was calm and good. And then the people followed us to the stall afterwards to ask us more questions and talk about veganism further at the stall, and to come and get their cupcake.
One thing you might find interesting, Gary, is as Renata mentioned, there were other food stalls there, and one of them was run by
Arid Lands Environment Center.
Yes, and they were serving camel burgers, because there's a lot of environmentalists in Australia, and Alice Springs in particular, who believe that that animal products generally are an environmental disaster. So instead, we should eat camels and kangaroos. And so just a few meters down from us, they were selling camel burgers. So that made for an interesting day as well.
In fact, this environment group has been pushing and promoting, they even call it cameltarianism and kangatarianism, and makes me wild. But anyway, they've pushed it so much that I've even talked to some environmentalist friends who are vegetarians and have actually started to eat kangaroo and camel because the environmentalists are saying it's good for the environment, that kangaroos emit very low amounts of carbon, and the argument behind camels is that they're bad for the environment and they damage the environment and they need to be eradicated and they're a pest. So that's their argument, and it's really crazy. And so we've had to, Jeff and I have had to do some research to debunk these environmental claims, which are just false anyway. It's really crazy. So I knew, I was determined to have a vegan presence at this eco fair because I went to the eco fair last year and I was just so cross.
It gets people's interest because several months ago I wrote an article in response to this whole phenomenon from an ethical abolitionist perspective, not even talking about debunking the environmental facts, but which is what Renata's good at. I wrote this article, and I don't know how many pages it is, but I had a couple of copies at our stall that day, and I was very surprised that people were reading it at the stall and they wanted to take it away with them. So, yeah, that was good.
Well, this is really fascinating because the two of you are doing an enormous amount, you're not working with any group. Is that correct?
No. I mean, we've started our own group, the Alice Springs Vegan Society.
Okay, and so you started your own group. You're not connected with any large group. You're not getting any funding. You're not a big money organization, and you're, I assume, putting your own resources into producing these cupcakes and things like that and giving them away.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's
right.
That's terrific. Now, what's really interesting to me is you look at, the two of you, and I assume that, you're not doing this full time. You're doing this in your spare time. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so it's not a full time. You're not full time advocates, but I would suggest that you're probably doing, probably having a much greater effect than a lot of people who are working for these large organizations and putting in their 40-hour weeks working as careerists in the animal advocacy movement. And it's interesting because you're doing things. You're writing articles. You're giving lectures. You're bringing all of the strands together. You're talking about the ethical issues and the reasons for abolition, the environmental costs and ecological costs of an animal based agriculture, and the health costs of an animal based agriculture. So you're bringing all the strands together, and you're doing it at the same time, so people aren't sort of confused about, well, if it's an environmental issue, is it okay for me if I eat camels, or if it's a health issue, can I cheat a little bit? You're bringing in the ethical arguments to deal with the weak points in the environmental, or the possibly weak points in the environmental and health aspects, and bringing in the environmental and health aspects to deal with the sorts of more practical and less theoretical concerns that a lot of people have. And it's interesting because just hearing the two of you talk, and you're in Alice Springs. Now, I've never been to Australia, let alone to Alice Springs, but it sounds as though it's an environment where there is a potential for negative responses, because you have...
Yeah, actually, I wanted to say something about that. I was expecting a lot of negative responses, but with the camel burger sellers on the one hand and the cattle ranchers being in the town
exactly
on the other. But I was pleasantly surprised. We didn't get any negative reaction that day, and we got a lot of positive reactions from many people, some of whom were vegetarian already and some of whom were not vegan but nearly vegan, some of whom were just normal omnivores. But, you can't really tell because you don't necessarily talk to people afterwards. But I can say with reasonable confidence that I think because we were there that day, some people were seriously thinking about going vegan, and maybe they have or they will.
Yeah, and I often say this is a zero-sum game, by which I mean we live in a world of limited time and resources, and you've got to figure out how you're going to use your limited time, because we're all going to die, and your limited resources. And so you can spend your time, you could have spent that same amount of time talking about cage-free eggs or about crate-free veal or...
I shudder when you say that.
Yeah, I know. But you could spend your time talking about that stuff. And the best sort of response that you could hope to get from talking about that, those sorts of issues, is that perhaps when someone goes to a store, they're going to buy cage-free eggs, which is basically an egg from an animal who has been tortured and is not all that different from a conventional battery egg, and that still involves animal exploitation. And so
that's right.
even if, and that's a big, you got to underline that five times, even if you actually reach people in that context, the most you can hope to get is that they're going to go and they're going to buy a cage-free egg. And what is that going to do, for the chickens, little if nothing, and what's it going to do for that person's personal development on this issue? And the answer is it's going to actually make them more comfortable about continuing to exploit animals. And what you and Renata are doing is... on your, you know, without a budget, without donations, without having a large organization behind you or being part of a large organization, with your own time, with your own resources, with your own labor, you're educating people about veganism. And to the extent that you're having contact with people at these sorts of events, you have a much greater potential for really affecting a life change in those people, because if they're listening to you and you affect them, the response you're going to get is for them to go vegan. Whether they go vegan immediately or whether they go vegan in stages or whatever, you planted a vegan seed there that if it sprouts will sprout into a real behavioral change and not
just...
Yeah,
I just have to repeat that we had an absolutely phenomenal response from all of the people who we talked with, so I was really pleasantly surprised about that.
Yeah, people were very friendly, and we had a steady flow of interest at our table, and the cupcakes were flying out the door. And people commented that our stall looked really professional. We had lots of posters printed, and it was under a beautiful blue gazebo tent, and so we had a lot of positive responses.
And I think they also respected us for having a consistent position, abolitionism. None of this, you know, what you're saying about cage-free eggs and so on, or it's all right to wear leather, or it's all right to race horses and so on. We were totally consistent across the board with our abolitionist perspective, and I think people really respected that and responded well to it.
Well, and you know, another part of what you're saying is, I know, Jeff, from past exchanges we've had, that you are very much into nonviolence as a general philosophy, and that you are into ahimsa, and I know that sort of affects or shapes and influences how you communicate with people, and part of the abolitionist approach, at least as I've been developing it for the past 20 some odd years, is that it involves creative, non-violent education. Can you and Renata address that for a second? Because I find it fascinating. One of the most fascinating aspects of this discussion is that you're doing abolitionist vegan advocacy in an environment that most people would look at and say, wow, that's going to be a real hard sell. You're dealing with cattle people. You're dealing with environmentalists who can be as hostile.
I think I'd rather deal with a cattle rancher than an environmentalist. They are the hardest people to get through. They're the most resistant people to the vegan message of all of them. They have very strong beliefs about, well, the indigenous people eat meat. It's natural. And so long as you eat, they equate ethics with sustainability. They've merged the two so strongly that they can't imagine, well, if you can eat meat sustainably and the animal has lived a wild, happy life, then you know, that's ethical. So yeah, they are very tricky to get through.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I would say the same thing. I would say that it's easier to talk to a group of institutional animal exploiters than it is to talk to a group of new welfarist advocates, because the latter get really hostile. The former will engage
you.
They may disagree with you, but they'll engage you. Whereas the latter, whether they're environmental advocates or whether they're just generally new welfarist type people, they get really angry and they don't want to engage you intellectually. And then they just sort of respond by insult or trying to insult you or mischaracterizing your position or whatever. So I do think it's very interesting. And what I find absolutely fascinating, I really do. I think what the two of you are doing is remarkable, and it's an example for everybody out there who's saying, what do I do next?
Thank you, Gary. I'd also like to say I was beside Jeff at the stall, and I really admired the way he interacted with the people. He's so calm, and he's like a Jedi. he's as cool as a cucumber. And when there's people just looking at the table, just showing interest or stuffing their face with cupcakes, I'm glad actually we laminated all our posters on the table because there were a lot of cake crumbs. So while people were just quietly reading, Jeff would approach them and initiate the conversation, usually with the same question: have you ever thought about veganism, or have you ever thought about going vegan? And I was really surprised lots of people said yes. I just assumed nobody's ever thought about it for themselves. But he'd start with that question, get them talking, and then use a really, really basic, simple analogy of, we love our family dog, and we would never want to hurt or eat our dog, and so therefore we don't want to hurt or kill other animals who aren't our pets as well. Really, really basic analogy, and it gets people thinking and talking, and they go, yeah, that's right, and then they'll start talking. So I loved watching Jeff. We have different approaches with the way that we talk to people, but Jeff never missed everyone that came to the table. Jeff made sure that he introduced himself and said hello. He was so calm and friendly, and the whole atmosphere, and that sets up the conversation with that first initial friendliness, and so I thought that was really wonderful.
Well, thank you, Renata.
It's terrific. Now, Jeff, talk a little bit about the nonviolent communication approach that you use.
Okay, but before I do, I just wanted to follow up on what Renata was just saying there. I guess a lot of what I do is, when I talk to people, is I just talk to them in a calm and friendly way, and I answer their questions or objections using rational arguments. In a simple way that most people can understand. And for the vast majority of people, I would say that's sufficient, and everything is cordial, and people become persuaded toward veganism and abolitionism. But on the other hand, you do get... I've had on occasion over the years some irate people who just want to yell at you or belittle you and so on. And one way I've learned to deal with situations like that is this thing called nonviolent communication. Basically, it's a way of both speaking and hearing others that lets you connect with people so that everyone's needs will be met. It involves a lot of empathy and understanding, so both people understand each other fully, and then making voluntary requests that meet people's needs. It can sound artificial, which turns a lot of people off. It can sound contrived and artificial, but there is something called street NVC where one can make efforts to make it not sound artificial.
And when you say street NVC, you mean street nonviolent communication?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Nonviolent communication. I guess I can just quickly summarize the classical nonviolent communication.
Well, Jeff, let's do a role play thing. All right, I come up to you in the store.
Oh, this will be good.
I come up to you, and you're standing there with all this literature And Renata's got cupcakes, and she gives me one, and I eat it, and I say, well, this is good, but, you know, I think this is all crazy. We're intended to be eating animals, and I think your position is crazy. What do you say to me?
Why do you think that?
Because it's natural to eat animals. It's a normal thing. We're supposed to be doing it. We've been doing it all of our lives. Everybody does it. It's how we evolved. It's necessary.
Well, I guess how I would proceed from there would depend on how loud and aggressive the person would be. Because my instinct, just from hearing what you said there, is just to start giving some irrational response. Like I would say,
let's say I'm angry, and I say to you, "Are you telling me I'm a bad person because I eat animal products?" Are you saying that? Because you're saying that we shouldn't be eating animal products. It's morally wrong. So you're saying I'm a bad person, aren't you? Give me another cupcake. But but you're saying I'm a bad person, aren't you, Jeff?
I'm not saying anything about you. I'm here suggesting that people go vegan. And when you hear me say that, it sounds like you're pissed off. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at your literature, and it's clear to me that you think that that eating animals and animal products is morally wrong, and so therefore you must be making a judgment about me. And I don't like it when people make judgments about me. And I come up to you and I say this, only I have an Australian accent.
So when you read here in this flyer that eating animal products is morally wrong, you don't like that, and you just want to go on eating animal products without getting judgments from me. Is that right?
Well, yes, that's right, because you are making a judgment about me, aren't you? Aren't you saying that I'm an immoral person?
What I'm saying is that... You're making me think, Gary.
Well, good, Jeff. That's my role in life.
I mean, surely you is empathy. So rather than fighting against you, going with it and repeating what you've said, empathizing back so that you feel heard and understood, because no one is going to listen to you unless they feel heard and respected. So Jeff was just bouncing back what you're saying. Is this how you're feeling?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah,
I'm,
damn right I'm feeling that
by
way.
By no means, I'm not any expert in nonviolent communication, so what I say to people might be a mix of nonviolent communication and just me. But I guess in answer to that, I would say, no, I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm saying I have an argument for why it's unethical to eat animal products. And you can agree or disagree with that argument, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, you know, actually, what I do in that situation, because I get that quite a bit, and I get it in a different context. I'm not doing these sorts of street events anymore. I did when I was younger, but I don't anymore. Now I'm doing it in classrooms. Now I'm having large group dynamics in classrooms. And frequently I will have students, either they'll come up afterward or they'll say in the middle of the class or the lecture, are you making a value judgment? Are you making a moral judgment about me as a person? And I always jump to that and say, no, absolutely not. I'm not here to make moral judgments. I'm not making moral judgments. I think making moral judgments about each other as a general matter is not a productive activity. What I'm doing is talking about actions, and I am smart enough to understand that behaviors come from a variety of different sources, and belief systems are very complex, and they deal with our families and our culture and our religious traditions, and they come from all these different sources and that have made us what we are and who we are, and you know, judging you is not what I'm here to do. I'm here to ask you, how do you think about this issue, and how can you justify? And you know, it's interesting, Jeff and Renata, because what I find is that most people agree with certain, I mean, like, as you use the example of talking to people about their companion animals. Well, I do that all the time. And, you know, because you can get, no one would eat their dog, no one would eat their cat. And so when you ask them, well, why do you think it's okay to eat a cow but not eat your dog or your cat? And you know, so you can get in that way. Or you can get in from the way of talking about unnecessary suffering. murdering. Everybody agrees. Yeah, it's wrong
I did that
to inflict.
A few times as well.
Yeah, I mean, everybody agrees with that. I've never found anybody who disagrees with that. And then once you just start exploring with them what unnecessary suffering really means, you know, they recognize that their understanding of it, that they accept it, and B, they haven't thought very critically about it because they realize that it starts leading in the vegan direction very, very quickly without a lot of complicated philosophy. So I do think that, you know, that we can have the, I mean, I get a lot of emails from people saying, when I try to talk to people about this, people get very angry. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the way we talk about it with people, and that it really is very important not to come across as judging them, and not, in fact, to be judging them, but to be looking at actions and institutional behaviors and cultural practices and saying, people, how can we make sense of this? We can't, and getting them to see we can't make sense of it. And I think that, I agree with both of you that nonviolent communication is really important here. You're dealing with cultural traditions. I mean, when you start talking with people about eating animal products, you start touching on things that are really very personal and emotional. Like, you know, you're talking about eating animal products and they're thinking you're attacking their grandmother who, you know, has made all of these wonderful meat and dairy products for them over the decades, and you know, and they associate, you know, with very, you know, warm feelings of affection and love and emotion and whatnot because of these various events that they've had at grandma's house.
It's true, and cultural things too. For example, some Aboriginal people think it's an attack on their. By the way, I don't go out of my way to find an Aboriginal person to have a conversation because they've got a whole lot of other issues, and I'd
sure.
rather an Aboriginal person
sure.
talk to an Aboriginal person about veganism. But I'm just talking about someone that I know very well who is Aboriginal who took offence that an attack on his personal culture. He said, "Well, this is my culture. Hunting kangaroos and emus and eating meat is a it's an ancient and deep part of my culture, and we have songs and ceremonies about this. And how dare you?" And so some people can really take it personally. And but then my argument for that is, well, actually, it's in everybody's culture. I don't think it's just Aboriginal culture. I think eating animals is deeply ingrained in every culture in the world, just about almost.
In response to that? Something similar actually happened to me in Canada when I was doing the video kiosk. A native Canadian came up to me and said something similar. And my response at the time was, well, he said, it's my religion to hunt and eat animals. And then my response was, well, every religion says that, but here's this other perspective. But in hindsight, I think I would have preferred to empathize with him a bit more because he was upset by what I was doing, and he was saying, this is my religion, and you're telling me what to do. And I just came back to him with this argument, well, actually, every religion condones using animals, and here's a rational argument for going vegan. But it might have been better had I said, well, give him a little bit of empathy and said, well, you see me here promoting veganism, and part of your spirituality is using animals or consuming animals. So it upsets you to see me doing this. Is that right? And yeah, just getting a little acknowledgement there before going into the arguments might have helped that interaction.
Well, you know, I think, and I'd like to end on this point. I think that, we're always well advised whenever we're in any educational situation, and when we're doing our advocacy, we're always in an educational situation, a potential educational situation. And I think that it always is a good idea to think about how to engage the person or people you're talking with in a creative, nonviolent way, and empathy is always a good default principle, because we are always dealing, when we're talking about this issue, we're always dealing with a religious tradition or a deeply held cultural view, and so whether we're dealing with a native person or not, you know, or someone from a non-indigenous group, as both of you pointed out, you're still dealing with cultural and religious traditions, and so it's always a good idea to be sensitive about that, and to never come across as judging the person or people you're talking with, but rather trying to be empathetic and trying to reach them in creative, nonviolent ways, because the more you do that, the more successful you'll be. It's inherently better to communicate that way, because we should be gentle in communicating with each other. But it's also, as a practical matter, it's a more effective way of communicating. You don't turn people off that way. You bring them in. You don't shove them out. And that's really what this is all about. It's not about winning debating points. It's about bringing people into a particular paradigm of non-exploitation, non-violence, and just saying no to animal exploitation. And that's going to be far more likely to be the case if we bring people in rather than sort of shoving them out with judgments and harsh communication.
Absolutely, but agree with you.
For me, it's a mix of debating points and empathy, because you get the empathy to have, you know, a good connection with the person and a good respectful interaction, and then you can bring in the debating points. And when you do, after, you know, having a good interaction, then the person is less likely to be hostile to your debating points and more likely to hear what those points actually are.
Well, yes, and again, I mean, when I said debating points before, I mean, I think there's no one who uses rational argument more than I do in virtually everything I do. But again, it doesn't help if all you're doing is presenting really good logical debating points or logical points, but you're not hitting the folks emotionally, and if people are hostile to what you're saying, or if they feel offended by or judged by what you're saying, they're not going to hear the rational arguments that you're making. So I think, you know, I mean, I agree with you that effective communication is not just a matter of rational argument. It's a matter of empathy. It's a matter of people of getting people to be open to those rational arguments, and to the extent that our communication is hostile or perceived to be judgmental or harsh or violent in any way, the rational arguments that are there, that are clearly there, that, I mean, have been the foundation of the work I've been doing all of my life in terms of, I mean, I think it's absolutely clear there is no rational argument that justifies animal exploitation. Not one. I've never heard one. And the arguments in favor of happy exploitation that now are circling the globe as a result of all these large animal welfare corporations that have a financial interest in promoting that message, it's completely irrational. It's completely illogical. In many ways, the success of those sorts of arguments has been in the emotional response that people give in terms of saying, well, but we've got to do something to help animals now, and they have that sort of emotional reaction, and then they're open to the illogical argument that what we need to do to help animals now is get people to eat cage-free eggs, which just doesn't make any sense. And what we need to do is to have people open emotionally so that they can hear the rational arguments. And
something that we get a lot in Alice Springs is people who have their backyard chickens.
Yeah, so yes.
So we had a lot of people, especially the environmentalists, who like to live sustainably and make their homes water efficient and energy efficient, and have a veggie garden and chickens in the backyard. And so we had quite a few people saying that at the stall. So we had to address that concern.
I gave two answers generally to that. Is one is I've spoken to a farmer who actually worked for the United Nations, going around
to developing countries and helping poor farmers become more efficient at exploiting animals. But he told me, even in those situations, that a hen who lays an unfertilized egg will still be upset if you remove the egg.
Absolutely.
So some people say that's not true. Some people say it is true. But anyway, that was one of my responses. Okay. The other one was domestication, that chickens have been domesticated for X thousand years, and, you know, that involves horrible exploitation as well.
And they're also made to, a natural chicken who lives in the jungle will lay two clutches of eggs a year, about 24 eggs in a year naturally, but they're bred to lay between 200 to 300 eggs every year in a farm situation. So, and all that excess egg laying leads to osteoporosis and a complete breakdown of their bodies. So even chickens that are in backyards are not going to lay that many eggs, but they're certainly going to lay a whole lot more than they ever naturally would ever lay. And also, I sometimes share a story. When I was in Hawaii, I saw some wild chickens in the rainforest, and I'd never seen that before. And they were really fast, and they were camouflaged, they were speckled, and there was a rooster with his harem, and there were little baby chicks, and they were out on the beach, and then when the tourists came to the beach, they all scurried into the rainforest, and that's the first time I'd seen what chickens are supposed to do. You know, this is freedom, and these chickens are happy, and they're safe in the rainforest, and this is the life that they want to live, and I'm sure if you gave these chickens a choice and said, here, would you like to come and live with me in my backyard? Sorry, I don't want the rooster to come here because they're aggressive and they're noisy, so we'll just eat him. But you can come and live with me and live in this in this cage, and we'll feed you and we'll take your eggs. Is that all right? I'm sure if you ask these wild chickens, they'd say, no thanks, I'll take the rainforest. And so, yeah.
And even those wild ones were probably domesticated
at some
point.
Yeah, they would have escaped into the wild at some point. But it was wonderful to see how they're supposed to live. This is, you know, how this is what they want. This is their choice. I also have a friend in Alice Springs who has her own chickens, and when I was visiting her, I saw a wooden egg, and I said, I've been wanting to find some wooden eggs for craft reasons, because my son Mirko, who's 6 years old now, when he goes to school, sometimes they have Easter activities where they paint an egg, but I don't want to use real eggs. I want to use a fake egg so he can still participate in the Easter activities. And I've been looking everywhere for a wooden egg. Where did you get it from? And then she would tell me the story about why she has a wooden egg. And the wooden egg is to deceive her backyard hens when they're laying, because if you take all of the eggs, They get upset, and the next time they lay eggs, they move, and they move their nest. They go somewhere else and hide where they can't be found, somewhere in the backyard. So if you come and take the eggs but replace it with a fake egg, they're happy and they'll stay there on that one fake egg and won't move their nest. So I'm just astounded that she would tell me this story and not think, well, doesn't that mean she doesn't like it and don't you think you should leave her alone? But I didn't say that because it wasn't really appropriate at the time. But it was just interesting to hear that story, because I didn't know that I thought that backyard hens were socially conditioned to just accept that their eggs are going to be taken and that, because, you know, they don't have any choice and they just don't care. But now, after hearing that, I realise they do care, even though they're not fertilised. That to the hen, their eggs are their babies.
They still care, even after all their independence has been bred out of them, and now they're wholly dependent on humans. And yeah, they couldn't survive on their own without us.
And the other notion that chickens are frightened. I mean, we use these derogatory terms: you pig, you chicken. But I've seen a hen defend her eggs with her life.
Absolutely.
Chickens are anything but frightened. They're very brave.
Well, we'll end on the idea that chickens are anything but chicken. No, I want to thank you both very much, because I think this has been this is the dogs agree. This is the first of what I hope will be a series of discussions with abolitionist vegan advocates in different parts of the world, and the experiences that they're having. having. And I have thoroughly enjoyed, I love the energy from the two of you, that I get from the two of you. And the work that you're doing is just terrific. And you're really demonstrating, you're an excellent example of creative, nonviolent vegan advocacy. You're doing it with your own money. You're doing it on your own time. And you're really setting an excellent example. Just think of what would be the case and what the different world we would live in if we had everybody who was concerned about animal issues and animal ethics doing this sort of work rather than promoting cage-free eggs or some welfare reform to get animals a bit more space or whatever, to make animal
exploitation. Or pangatarianism or cameltarianism.
Exactly. You know, that would be
absolutely amazing if all... everyone who's concerned about animals did that. We would have a very different world.
We would have a
movement.
Absolutely. We'd have a very different world, and we would have a real movement rather than the joke that exists now that is called the animal movement, because unfortunately it is nothing but a joke.
And part of our advocacy is actually talking to vegans as well. We have to educate the vegans also. Yes,
I'm well aware of that. In a future commentary, I would like to talk with you, because you have kids, and I would like to talk with you about how you deal with vegan kids and the sorts of interactions you have with other parents and schools and things like that, but we don't have time to do that.
Our son is already an activist. You should see him go.
Well, there you go. There you go. Well, with parents like you, I can see how that would be likely. Either that, or he's going to become. Either your kid is going to become a really effective animal advocate, or is going to become a cattle rancher in Alice Springs. One of the two. One of the two. I can assure you there will be no in between point. Well, thank you both very, very much. Do you have a website that deals with this or
no, not yet.
Okay, but do you think you'll have one in the future?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I would really encourage that, because I think that one of the things that's really important is for abolitionists to be communicating with each other. And look, the internet brought the two of you together, as you fell in love online, I think was the quote from Renata. And I agree, the internet can be a really effective tool for communication and education. And I think it's really important for other vegan abolitionist advocates and aspiring advocates to learn about the experiences of others, and the internet is a great place to do that. So thank you both very, very much. I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking with you both in the future and to hearing more about your advocacy efforts.
Thank you very much for having us, Gary.
Okay, well, that ends commentary number 20. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have enjoyed hearing from Jeff Purs and Renata Peters about their vegan advocacy in Alice Springs, Australia. And I hope that the message that we've taken away from this is that vegan advocacy can go on anywhere if we really want it to go on. So we can engage in vegan advocacy in just about any context in which we find ourselves. We just have to think about how best to do creative, nonviolent vegan education wherever we find ourselves. And we can do it just about anywhere. So I will in the future be talking with other abolitionist vegans and about their outreach activities and their educational activities, and we'll see the range of things that people are doing as part of the emerging grassroots vegan movement. Well, I'll end with the same thing I always end with. It's a message that I think bears repetition. If you're not vegan, please go vegan. It's very, very easy. And you know what? To the extent that you find it a little inconvenient or whatever, or a little difficult, although I can't imagine why you would, but let's assume that you do. To the extent that you find it difficult, I'd like you to think about how difficult it is for the billions of animals that we exploit that you're not vegan. It's very easy. It's better for your physical health. Animal products are killing us. It's better for the planet. Animal agriculture is destroying the environment. And most important, it's the morally right thing to do. You know, we hear all the time about compassion. I mean, that's a word I would, in many ways, like to abolish from the vocabulary, because everybody thinks, you know, compassion is a great idea, but yet we have all sorts of injustice to humans and to non-humans. So for a group of people who embrace compassion, it seems that most of us think that compassion is consistent with a lot of unjust conduct. And so I would suggest that veganism is not a matter of compassion. It's a matter of fundamental justice. It's what we owe to animals. It's not a question of our mercy or our charity or our largesse. It's a matter of what we owe to them. We owe to them not to use them. We owe to them not to exploit them. We owe to them not to treat them as property. We owe to them not to treat them as things. So veganism is not only easy, it's not only better for your health, it's not only better for the planet, it's the just thing to do. So please, go vegan if you're not vegan.